Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
It was June 3rd, 2001, the first time that we met in this building as a public church. GCA went public exactly 25 years ago tonight. And that just seems like a significant moment. So I thought I'd say it out loud just so that it is part of the permanent record on the website. As we've been here through these 25 years, we have seen a litany of churches in the area rise up and then disappear. And oftentimes it's because they just can't handle their financial obligations. But we have been so remarkably blessed here with this building because we were only in it a very short time when we were suddenly able to just pay it off. So we've been debt-free for most of our 25 years. So we've had a permanent home here, and I'm just so grateful 25 years later. The little group, the little ragtag bunch of us that started here together, I don't think ever dreamed that 25 years later we'd still be here, or even more astoundingly, that I'd still be here. And yet, here we are. So I'm very, very grateful to God for his faithfulness and his provision. All right, we have a long way to go tonight. We are in the book of Nahum, or as it is pronounced in Hebrew, Nahum. We introduced the book of Nahum 3 weeks ago, and then owing to a virus, I missed two Wednesdays in a row. And so I'm going to still pick up right where I left off because to anybody listening on the internet, it's a very short hop from the last recording to this one. Even though I feel like I ought to review a little bit, I'm going to resist that temptation. We got as far as verse 9. Now, the important thing to remember that I did really stress in the introduction to this book is the idea of national gods. Different groups of people, different nations of people have individual gods. Some of those nations and groups of people, like the Assyrians, are named after their god, whereas Yahweh is demonstrating in books like Nahum that he is the God of everybody. The first part of chapter 1 of the book of Nahum describes him as the God who is the creator God, the sovereign over everyone and everything. And that is to make him distinct from, unique from, all the other historic gods of all the other people. The concept in ancient warfare was that if any people group could conquer another people group, it was also a way of conquering their God, of demonstrating that their God was not able to protect them. Which is why when God scattered Israel, part of the taunt against them was, "Where is your God? How come your God wasn't able to protect you? Now you're in this scattered state." But Nahum, who is talking in his entire book, all three chapters are about the fall of Nineveh and ultimately the fall of Assyria. Along the way, he has good things to say about Judah, but he is also demonstrating the difference between Yahweh and all the other gods, all the other national gods. And there are several distinctions as you go through the Old Testament that make Yahweh different than every other god. It's why he begins his commandments with the idea of, you'll have no other gods before me. I am the only God. And my name is unique and distinct. Don't take my name in vain. And don't make graven images, and don't make idols and bow down to them, because that's what the foreign nations did with their gods. Well, those other gods, those foreign gods, might be wood and stone and metal, but they can't think, they can't talk, they can't protect, they can't do the things that Yahweh does, they can't create. And so as a consequence, people groups gave credit to their gods. They would choose the gods that they would then worship, whereas Yahweh chose his people, the people who would worship him. And that is an enormous distinction between the God of the Bible and all of the other foreign gods. In fact, when we're talking about Israel, starting from Abraham, the biblical record is that God created his nation. He chose Abraham and then talked about the offspring, the seed of Abraham, and what was going to happen with that people group. And that is unique, again, between Yahweh and all the other gods. But the God who identifies himself with his people, usually people would identify with their gods, which is why the Assyrians are named after Asher, their god. But Yahweh identifies with his people, so he calls himself the God of Israel. He calls himself the Redeemer of Israel, the Savior of Israel. He identifies directly with his people, and then, of course, sent his son to be part of the lineage, part of the family line of the people he chose. So there are all these unique characteristics to Yahweh that the other gods simply cannot claim. So as we're reading through Nahum here, watch for those demonstrations of the uniqueness and the power of God to conquer Nineveh and the gods of Nineveh. Because Nineveh, at this time when Nahum is writing, Nineveh is the primary power in the Middle East. And yet Nahum is talking about their utter destruction and that they're going to be completely wiped out. A jealous and avenging God is Yahweh. Yahweh is avenging and wrathful. Yahweh takes vengeance on his adversaries. He reserves wrath for his enemies. Yahweh is slow to anger and great in power. And Yahweh will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. That's the way this oracle of Nineveh begins. It starts with, who is Yahweh? And what is Yahweh like? We begin tonight in chapter 9 after that brief introduction. Whatever you devise against Yahweh, he will make a complete end of it. So there's nothing any other gods can do. Now, Yahweh is going to destroy other nations, and as he is going to say later in this same letter, in this same prophecy, he's going to say that he is going to conquer the idols that belong to Assyria. But whatever they devise against him, well, because he is the sovereign, because he's the powerful one, he's going to bring it to a complete end. Now, this happens to be within the context of a promise to Jerusalem in particular. You might recall that historically the Assyrians conquered the northern 10 tribes, and the Assyrian army got as far as the gates of Jerusalem and laid a siege to Jerusalem, but they weren't able to take Jerusalem because an angel of the Lord showed up and killed 185,000 of their army in one night. You can read about that in 2 Kings 19:35. And so even though they got as far as Jerusalem, and even though they were able to begin their siege against Jerusalem, they had to abandon it and they had to go back home. Well, that again is a demonstration, a proof that they were devising a plan against the people of God. God took it personally and said, whatever you devise against me, against Yahweh, I'll make a complete end of it. But then the phrase, distress will not rise up twice, is a guarantee to Jerusalem against Assyria that you're not going to do that again to my people. You're not going to come lay siege to Jerusalem. And you know what? They never did. Because that's the kind of power that Yahweh has. Like tangled thorns, and like those who are drunken with their drink, they, the armies of Assyria, they are consumed as stubble, completely withered. From you has gone forth one, this is a reference to the king of Assyria, from you has gone forth one who plotted evil against Yahweh. He is a wicked counselor. Okay, now that is again a demonstration that Yahweh takes it personally when you attack his people. They did not attack Yahweh directly. They attacked Jerusalem. They attacked Israel. But part of that ancient Middle Eastern warfare attitude was, if we can conquer you as a people, we have conquered your God. So Yahweh takes that personally and says, from you has gone forth the idea, your leader, your king, from you has gone forth one who plotted evil against Yahweh. He's a wicked counselor. So thus says the Lord. And then starting here at verse 12, he's talking about Judah. He's talking about safety for Judah. Judah doesn't have to worry about Assyria. Thus says Yahweh, though they are at full strength, and likewise many, he's still talking about the Assyrians, even so they will be cut off and they will pass away. Though I have afflicted you, Jerusalem, Judah, though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no longer. What did Yahweh just do? He just took personal credit for the fact that Assyria not only took the northern 10 tribes into captivity, but the fact that they did come down on Judah. God protected them, but he used them as a way to afflict his people and then delivered them from the affliction. So even though, I'm stressing this again, even though the Assyrians are named after their national god, it is Yahweh himself who says, I used you. I'm in control of you. I'm the sovereign one. I brought you down on my people, and then I stopped you. And then I conquered you. And I did all of that for the benefit of Judah, my people. Even so, they will be cut off and they will pass away. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no longer. So now I will break his yoke bar from upon you and I will tear off your shackles. There's a fellow, Nabopolassar, who was the king of Babylon and the first king of the Chaldean dynasty. And he, along with a guy named Cyaxares the Mede, actually conquered Nineveh in 612 BC. This is what God is talking about. I'm going to break his hold on you, his yoke on you, and I will tear off his shackles from you. This is about the safety for Judah, the restoration for Judah. God used Assyria to correct and punish Israel and Judah. But in Judah, there was that attack in 701 BC. Judah ended up paying tribute to Assyria, and Judah's king, Manasseh, was taken captive then. You can read about that in 2 Chronicles 33:11. So there actually was a yoke from Assyria on Judah, and God takes credit for it and says, I broke that off of you now, and I will tear off the shackles that he has put on you. So As I said a moment ago, how did he end up destroying Assyria? By using Babylon. Did Babylon have their own gods? Well, yes, and plenty of them. So he continues to demonstrate his ability to utilize people groups who are worshiping other gods, who are even named after other gods, and yet he is the superior sovereign God. Verse 14, the Lord has issued a command concerning you. He's talking again to Assyria. Your name, he's probably talking to the king of Assyria at this point, your name will no longer be perpetuated. I will cut off idol and image from the house of your gods, and I will prepare your grave because you are contemptible. Behold, on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace, in other words, Yahweh is saying, once I have broken you off, and once I have conquered your idols, your images, your worship, your gods, I'm going to cut your name off. I'm going to cut off the yoke and the bondage that you have placed my people under. And when I do that, there are going to be people shouting from the mountaintops, as it were, and shouting that finally there is peace. Behold, on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace. So celebrate your feasts, O Judah. Pay your vows. Go back to the appropriate worship of your God, Yahweh. For never again will that wicked one, the very same one who a moment ago he referred to as the wicked counselor, never again will that wicked one pass through you, Jerusalem. That word, by the way, translated wicked one, is the word Belial or Belial. You've probably heard of the sons of Belial, the sons of wickedness. And so here he is Belial himself. He is wicked incarnate, but nevermore will he pass through God's people because he is cut off completely. Now remember, when Nahum is saying these things, Assyria is the most powerful force in the Middle East. And yet Nahum is saying something that is seemingly impossible. And yet he continues on and says, the one who scatters has come up against you. He's now saying to Assyria, you're going to be scattered. I'm going to bring up an army against you. And when he gets into the details, it's very obvious and clear who he's talking about. He's talking about Babylon. The one who scatters has come up against you. So man your fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon your strength. For Yahweh will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel. There, yet again, is another prophet consistent with all the prophets of the Old Testament declaring a restoration for Israel. And he calls them Israel and Jacob. So it's clear that he's talking about all 12 tribes, and he's talking in particular about the northern tribes that have gone into the Assyrian captivity. Those tribes have yet to be restored. And yet the Bible consistently prophesies this time of restoration and splendor for Jacob. That is like the splendor of Israel. Once upon a time, they were the chief nation in the Middle East. Under Solomon, there was nobody that could touch them. Once upon a time, Jerusalem was a splendid place. And so God points at that and says, I'm going to restore you to that level of splendor, and that has not happened yet. For Yahweh will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, even though devastators have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches. And then he returns to talking about Babylon and the armies of Babylon and the armies of the fellow I named a moment ago, Nabopolassar, who was the first king of Babylon. The shields of his mighty men are colored red, and his warriors are dressed in scarlet. The chariots are flashing steel when he is prepared. Now, the NASB adds the words prepared to march, but it's just prepared, prepared to go to war, prepared to conquer. And the cypress spears are brandished. The chariots race madly in the streets. They rush wildly into the squares. Their appearance is like torches. They dash to and fro like lightning flashes. He remembers their nobles. Now he's talking about the king of Assyria, the same way that he's about to be conquered and the same way that God describes the impressive armies that are going to conquer them. Then Assyria is going to remember his nobles, his leaders, and recognize their inability to do anything against Babylon. He remembers his nobles. They stumble in their march. They hurry to her wall. They run to hide, and the mantlet is set up. The gates of the rivers are opened, and the palace is dissolved. It is fixed. In other words, it is determined. This is going to happen. She is stripped. She is carried away. And her handmaids are moaning like the sound of doves and beating on their breasts. Though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days, now they are fleeing. And then there's the language of stop, stop, turn back. That's the idea of the stop, stop there in the NASB. It's no, no, don't run away. Engage the battle. Stop, stop. But no one turns back. Babylon is going to conquer utterly and completely. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there is no limit to the treasure. Wealth from every kind of desirable object. She, speaking of Nineveh, is emptied. Yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting, knees are knocking. Also, anguish is in their whole body, and all their faces are grown pale. Now, once upon a time, Nineveh and Assyria considered themselves like lions, unconquerable. That imagery continues through Babylon. Babylon used the imagery of lions a lot. It continues to this day. If you see the House of Windsor over in England and you see their heraldry, they use lions because those are the sort of unconquerable animals. And so God mocks them about their use of lion imagery and says, where is the den of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion, the lioness, and the lion's cub used to prowl with nothing to disturb them? In other words, where's that at now? Where's that level of bravery now when all your leaders are running and hiding? The lion tore enough for his cubs. He killed enough for his lioness. He filled his lairs with prey and his dens with torn flesh. He used to be able to conquer, but where is he now? Behold, says God, I am against you, declares Yahweh of armies. I will burn up her chariots with smoke. A sword will devour their young lions. I will cut off the prey from your land, and no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard. That's the end of chapter 2. It is all poetic language describing the conquering of Nineveh by Babylon to the benefit of Judah. And that's a historic reality. This was all being predicted before it actually happened, but that is the way it actually occurred. And so God, Yahweh, is demonstrating yet again, the God of Israel is demonstrating again, that he not only can conquer whatever people group he chooses, that their gods cannot protect them from the strength, the superior power and sovereignty of Yahweh. And he is demonstrating that they, as a people, are all under his sovereign hand and his sovereign command, because he can use them for the benefit or for the punishment of his people, Israel. It's a really, really sovereign God. And that takes us to chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 1. Woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. Her prey never departs. The voice of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheel, galloping horses and bounding chariots, horsemen charging, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, a mass of corpses, and countless dead bodies. They stumble over the dead bodies. All because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries, and who sells families by her sorceries. Behold, I am against you, declares Yahweh of armies. And I will lift up your skirt over your face, and I will show to the nations your nakedness, and to the kingdoms your disgrace. That's the whole idea. He is not just conquering them as a people. Nahum has described the warfare that is coming, the whips, the wheels, the horses, the chariots, the spears, the many that are laying dead, the corpses that you have to trip over just to be able to walk. He describes the warfare, but part of the warfare is also a shaming of them as a people because of their wickedness, because of their foreign gods, because of their sorceries and the ways they took advantage of other people and other nations by their trading, by their unjust, unrighteous ways of dealing with other people. He's going to get into that, the trade as well. And so he likens it to the idea of, I'm going to lift your skirt and demonstrate your nakedness to everybody, because after all, you are a harlot, so now I'm going to shame you in the streets. I'll show the nations your nakedness. I'll show the other kingdoms your disgrace. And I will throw filth on you, and I will make you vile, and I will set you up as a spectacle, so that people can look on you, so that people can mock you. I'm going to use you as an example of my ability to conquer, because you are. Remember again, Nineveh is the most powerful nation in the area. So when they fall, and when their fall is utter and complete, you can see how the other nations are just going to marvel at it, are going to look at it and say, how did this happen? And Yahweh is saying, I'm going to use you as a spectacle. I'm going to openly shame you to demonstrate to the other nations how unrighteous, how truly wicked you have been. And it will come about that all who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. And who will grieve for her? Where will I seek comforters for you? In other words, you're going to be so openly destroyed, it's going to be such a wonder and a marvel to the other nations how quickly and completely you are destroyed. I'll tell you now, it takes about 3 years. It happens really quickly. When they go down hard. And he says the other nations are going to look at you and then get away from you. They're not going to want any part of whatever that destruction is. They're going to say, Nineveh's devastated, but we're not going to grieve over it. And where are you going to find comforters for you? Verse 8 says, are you better than Noaman, That's an Egyptian city. You know it probably better by the name Thebes. Actually, Assyria conquered Thebes in 663 BC. And the Hebrews called that city No-Amon, or the city of the god Amon. Because, just like Assyria itself, as a group, as a national people, were named after their national god, Assur, or Asher, the city in Thebes, down in Egypt, was named after their god, Amun. So again, you have to remember that the conquering of these various people groups is also a conquering of their gods. Anyway, that city was built on the eastern bank of the Nile River, but then it had like suburban areas on both shores of the Nile. So all of those waterways, the canals, the moats, the river itself protected Thebes. It acted like a wall to protect them. Now notice that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is aware of all that because he's the universal God. So he knows the cities that are dedicated to other gods down in Egypt. And he also knows that that city that seemed impregnable fell to the Assyrians. And so now God, in mocking Assyria, says, you're no better than Thebes. You think you're impregnable. You think you're unconquerable. The same way you conquered them, I'm going to conquer you. Are you better than No-Amon, which was situated by the waters of the Nile, with waters surrounding her, whose rampart, whose wall, whose protection was the sea, whose wall consisted of the sea? And then Thebes had made deals, protective agreements and covenants with some of the surrounding areas, Ethiopia and Egypt, Put, Lubim. And yet they couldn't save Thebes when Assyria conquered them. So God, in pointing out the futility of making agreements with other men to try to protect you against Yahweh, the ultimate God, says, Ethiopia was her might, and Egypt too, without limits. Put and Lubim were among her helpers, and yet she became an exile. And she went into captivity, and also her small children were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. They cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound with fetters. And so you too will become drunk. You will be hidden. You too will search for a refuge from the enemy. All your fortifications are like fig trees with ripe fruit, and when shaken, they will fall into the eater's mouth. The language of mockery that's being used here. Your mighty men, your strongest men, are going to be like trees full of ripe fruit where all you got to do is shake them. You don't have to get up there and pick it. You don't have to do a whole lot of work. All you got to do is shake that tree and all of it's going to fall. And God likens that to the leaders within Assyria when Babylon comes to conquer them. He says, they're all just going to fall. They're going to collapse in front of you. All your fortifications are fig trees with ripe fruit. When shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth. Behold, your people are women in your midst. He's saying they're not going to man up. They're not going to show, they're not going to demonstrate the strength that they're supposed to as the armies, as the leaders, as the fortifiers of your nation. Instead, they're going to run scared. All your people are women in your midst. The gates of your land are opened wide to your enemies. I mean, the gate was the final fortification. Everybody come into the city, come behind the wall, close the gates. It's the final way to protect your people from the invaders. And yet God says, your gates are going to be wide open. Once Babylon conquers, they're going to open your gates and flow right into your city. They're going to conquer utterly and completely. The gates of your land are opened wide to your enemies, and fire consumes your gate bars. Now, by the way, there is still archaeological evidence over there where Assyria used to be, demonstrating that Nineveh was conquered primarily by fire. It burned, which is a typical Middle Eastern warfare tactic, the same way that Babylon will later burn Jerusalem, the same way that the Romans burned it in 70 AD. But sure enough, Nineveh was conquered by fire as well as by overwhelming armies. So God was right. The details are accurate. The gates of your land are open wide to your enemies, and fire consumes your gate bars. Draw for yourself water for the siege. In other words, he's saying, go behind your walls and get ready. You're about to be under siege. So folks would go behind the walls. They'd go into the city. They would store up food. They would store up water because they didn't know how long the enemy would be outside their gates. And so God says, okay, prepare yourself because the siege is coming. Draw for yourself water for the siege. Strengthen your fortifications. Go into the clay and tread the mortar. In other words, continue building your walls. Make stronger bricks. Get ready. Take hold of the brick mold there, in that very place, in the very place where you are building your fortifications, within your city where you think you're safely behind your gates, in the place that you trust in that very place, the fire will consume you. And the sword will cut you down, and it will consume you as the locust does. Now, in these next several verses, Nahum is going to talk a lot about locusts. And I don't know if we have any entomologists in the crowd, and I'm just happy to have used the word entomologist tonight. That means the study of insects. But he's going to talk a lot about locusts, because if you're living in the Middle East and you are dependent on growing crops in order to eat and survive, one of the chief ways that a crop can be utterly destroyed is if there is a swarm of locusts. They're very conscious of locusts, much more so than we are right now in the 21st century living in Middle Tennessee. We might have an occasional outburst of cicadas, but we don't have destructive locusts. As a consequence, they are so locust aware that they have names for various stages of locusts. And in the Hebrew, you see a series of names for each type of locust. For instance, first off, you're going to see grasshoppers, and actually, depending on your translation, I think the better translation is the canker worm, the one that eats your crops completely. But the three stages of locust development are first, in the Hebrew, the yeleg, which is a recently emerged, young, can't fly yet. He's kind of a hopper. He's not a great danger, but if there's a whole swarm of them, you can't kill them all. And they're going to develop, and they're going to do damage. As they grow, they become what the Hebrews called hasil, which literally means the devourer. Because once they're old enough to eat, now they start devouring the crops. But even that word hasil, usually refers to singular or individual insects, locusts. So they also have a word, arbe, which is the most destructive adult type of locust. And the word actually means, that word, arbe, means multitudinous. You're talking about a huge number of locusts now who can eat, who can destroy, and who, once they fully grow, can also fly. And so they are really destructive. Now, by the way, Nahum is going to compare the armies of Nineveh and the leaders of Nineveh to these different stages of locusts, which is just really interesting because by the time he gets to the leaders are the only ones that can afford, as the Babylonian armies are approaching, they're the only ones who can afford to get away. They run away. They take off. So he likens them to the fully grown arbe, the flying one, who fly away. They flee away. There is also a Hebrew term for large swarms of flying locusts. It is gobhai, I think is the way it's pronounced. In one biblical lexical source that I looked up, it means a swarm of locusts. So all of this combined, what we're about to read, is a description of the officials and the leaders there in Nineveh just running away. And so he compares them to the locusts. So then starting in verse 15, the fire will consume you, the sword will cut you down, and it will consume you as the locust does. So there's the first comparison. The same way that the locusts, especially the ones that are hungry, the ones that are eating, the young ones before they can fly, who are the devourers, he says the sword of Babylon is going to come upon you like those kind of devouring locusts. It will consume you as a locust does. So multiply yourself like the creeping locust. He's there talking about the young locusts, the ones that are just coming up, the ones who can't fly yet. And multiply yourself like the swarming locusts. Okay, now he's talking about the arbe. Now he's talking about the huge multitudinous groups of locusts. You have increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. I mentioned to you a moment ago that one of the things that Yahweh has against Assyria is the way that they made forcible trading deals with the different nations that they conquered. And that became a burden to those other nations that they were required to trade with the Assyrians. You have increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. And the creeping locust strips and flies away. I think he's there talking about the leaders in Nineveh who, without anywhere else to go, they just take off because they can afford to. They run away. In fact, as we're closing up the book of Nahum here, these closing words are probably all addressed to a king who went by the name of Sinshar Ishkun. He was the king who was ruling Nineveh when it was destroyed in 612 BC. Or perhaps, and maybe more likely, it's referring to King Ashur Abalit, who is one of those who could afford to flee away. He kept the Assyrian idea alive for another 3 years. He tried to hold the Assyrian Empire together, but he fled to the city of Haran. And he tried to rule from there until it also crumbled completely in 609 BC, which was 3 years after Nineveh's fall. So again, the fall of the Assyrian Empire was very, very quick. And their attempts to run away, their attempts to flee, their attempts to get away from the onslaught that was coming proved to be a complete failure. Your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts. They also take off. Your marshals are like the hordes of grasshoppers, says the NASB, which is a very strange translation because, again, it is the word arbe. It is these swarms of multitudinous locusts. Your marshals are like the hordes, the arbe of flying locusts. Settling in the stone walls on a cold day, but when the sun rises, they flee. That is the character of multitudinous flying locusts. And so he says, that's what your leaders are like. Your traders, your guardsmen, your marshals, your kings, your leaders, they're going to run away. They're not going to protect you. They're not going to help you. When Babylon comes, they're going to run away. They're going to try to save their own necks. And they're not going to preserve you as a people, despite what you hope your God would be able to do to protect you. Nevertheless, you're going to be conquered by Babylon and the gods of Babylon, all of whom are under the actual headship of Yahweh, the God of everything. Your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts. Your marshals are like hordes of locusts settling in the stone walls in the cold day. And the sun rises and they flee, and the place where they are is not known. Your shepherds, your leaders, the people who are supposed to look out for you, your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. That's why I said these last few words are right to the king of Assyria, whether it's to Sinshar Ishkun, which I'm just happy to get to say again, or whether he's talking to Ashur-Abulit, the final runaway king. The ones who are supposed to be doing the judging, the leading, the supporting within the community, those shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles are laying down. They're not standing up to fight. They're not defending you. Your people are scattered on the mountains, and there is no one to regather them. Even though there was that 3-year attempt to gather Assyria again under the headship of the city of Haran, ultimately that also fell. That also crumbled. God knew that in advance. He knew what was going to happen. And so he could say, your people are scattered and there's no one to regather them, which, by the way, to this very day, Assyria has never been regathered. Do you think Yahweh knows what he's talking about? Because he knows human history. He has declared and decreed human history. And when he says something is going to be destroyed and never rise again, that's what happens. And finally, verse 19. There is no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you. This is a sign of derision. This is a sign of, it's not applause. It's not, oh, yay. It's a sign of what has happened here. And then Nahum finishes his prophecy, this book of the Bible, with a question, which is really interesting. There's only one other book in the Old Testament that ends with a question. Do you know what it is? It's Jonah. And we began the introduction to both Jonah and Nahum by saying that they are connected. They were predicting an end to Nineveh. When Jonah predicted an end to Nineveh, God relented because they repented. Under Nahum, he describes their ultimate destruction that actually does come to pass. And they both finish their prophecies with a question, which I just find interesting. And the question is, for on whom has not your evil passed continually? So that's why you're going to fall. That's why you're going to be destroyed. That is why Yahweh said continually, I am against you, because your evil, the influence of Assyria, spread over the whole known Middle Eastern world. That's how wide and broad their influence was, and why it was so unthinkable that they could be utterly conquered and utterly destroyed. And what did it take to utterly destroy and conquer the chief nation in the Middle East? Impregnable Assyria. What did it take for them to finally fall? It took Yahweh, the God of Israel, who could use armies of Babylon and then would use Babylon in order to correct his people, Judah, But when that happened, even Jeremiah said in advance, this will be a 70-year deal. And then when Daniel was in Babylon, Daniel prayed, make sure it's 70. The 70 years are up. Do what you said you're going to do. And sure enough, he brings his people back. And that is what we read about in the restoration, the rebuilding of the temple and the walls and the reestablishment of Jerusalem up until Christ comes. 70 AD, he does it again. That time he does it through the Romans. So whether we're talking about Assyria, whether we're talking about Egypt, whether we're talking about Babylon, whether we're talking about Rome, really, whether we're talking about Medo-Persia, whether we're talking about any of the nations that ever dealt with Israel, that ever conquered Israel, they only conquered because Yahweh used them in order to correct and punish his people Israel, because he is, after all, and I want to put a really fine point on this, because I think so much of modern Christianity ignores this fact, he is the God of Israel. And so the idea that he is later going to either abandon Israel, or that Israel is subsumed into the modern church, any of that language, any of the replacement language, any of the fulfillment language that is so, so common in modern Christianity is ignoring the fact that Yahweh, the God of the Bible, identifies Israel as his people, his unique people, and the entire history of the world revolves around the God, the creator of everything, dealing with his particular people. And don't ignore that. And that's what Nahum is about. Now, if I can stay upright, and if I can avoid any more viruses, next week we will venture into the next of the minor prophets.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.